sick, screwed up, or just lazy? The provocative title of a talk given by psychiatrist John Girardini, and which I chaired at the Adelaide Festival of Ideas this month. On All in the Mind today, that talk. Hello, Natasha Mitchell joining you. This year's festival theme was Planning for Uncertainty, and featured all sorts of sessions linking science, health, politics, ethics, the great play spaces for uncertainty, surely. A child psychiatrist at the Women's and Children's Hospital and professor in psychiatry and paediatrics at the University of Adelaide, John Girardini is something of an activist in his profession. He's a spokesperson for the group called Healthy Skepticism, which takes aim at misleading pharmaceutical drug promotion in psychiatry and medicine. In fact, you might have heard him coincidentally on Background Briefing's investigation of the issue last week. He's also chair of Australian-Palestinian Partnerships for Education and Health. In the last couple of years, you won't have failed to notice that mental health, particularly the mental health of young people, has been placed front and centre on the agenda in Australia. Psychiatrist Pat McGorry's stint as Australian of the Year last year certainly contributed to that focus, as did the Get Up campaign, which mobilised loudly around mental health in the lead up to the 2010 federal election. But despite the mental health of young people being his core concern and passion, Dr. John Girardini's worried, as he'll explain.
Thank you. As part of the Get Up campaign that Natasha's told you about earlier this year, we were told that 750,000 young Australians are locked out of mental health care that they desperately need. That means that five young people in every classroom are desperately sick, and that's something that I have a healthy scepticism about. I have no doubt that there are many young people who are troubled and suffering, and that this might be quite dangerous for them. They might be using alcohol in a dangerous way. They might be experiencing significant physical impairments, fatigue, distress, and so on. And they might be very unhappy. But none of that means that they're sick. Distress demands explanation, and sickness is unexplanatory for the suffering of young people. And the archetype, when we think about sickness, what comes to mind for most of us when we're thinking about somebody being sick are the cases like heart attacks or cancer or whatever, where there's something very obvious and overt that goes wrong with the body that may or may not have a treatment. When it does, the treatment's often quite dramatic in its impact on the person's well-being. That kind of archetype does have its place within psychiatry, or it did have. Syphilis filled psychiatric hospitals 100 years ago. By the identification of the spirochete and its treatment, we eliminated a whole range of psychiatric illness. And there's a huge amount of energy in psychiatry, I think, which hopes that one day we'll be able to replicate the syphilis story somewhere else in psychiatry. But we haven't yet, and I don't think the prospects are particularly promising. So most of what we call sickness is not really like heart attacks or cancer or syphilis. And I want to spend a little bit of time talking about why we think of ourselves as sick, what contributes to that. The first thing is that there's a repertoire of symptoms available to us. On average, each of you will have had 30-odd symptoms in the last week. I know personally I've had several this morning. Whether they are physical symptoms like headaches or upset stomachs, or psychological symptoms like angst or despondency, they tend to come and go throughout the week, and we give them more or less attention according to our circumstances. At the same time, we have feelings, emotional feelings, sadness, anger and fear and so on, and each of those has a bodily manifestation. So we're experiencing churning stomach, sweatiness, fatigue, whatever it is that might be a somatic manifestation of our ordinary emotional feelings. And then there's, I think this is a particularly modern thing, the idea that everything we experience in our body is medical, in the domain of doctors. Shyness would be a recent example of something that has a very intense somatic experience associated with us that I don't think anybody ever really thought of as any kind of illness or disease. But increasingly over the last decade or so, has been co-opted into disease structures. Now, all of those symptoms and experiences that come and go tend to have a fairly transitory effect unless we're in some kind of altered state of arousal, and that might be something that's brought on by tiredness or by emotional distress or by intoxication. And in those circumstances, those little feelings that we hardly notice in our body might become a focus for our attention, and our preoccupation with them may lead to their persistence. And then there's a range of social forces that have an impact on how we interpret those bodily experiences in our minds and in our emotions. I'm not going to have time to go into a range of the broad social forces that shape our investment in illness, but just to talk a little bit about some of the new diseases that we doctors have made available for you throughout the lifespan, starting from gastroesophageal reflux disease in infants, through attention deficit disorder in children, irritable bowel syndrome, chronic fatigue syndrome, all of these conditions which, when defined very rigorously, might not include terribly many people, but are pretty much available for anybody who wants to join the club if you take them a little bit more loosely. And I'd probably want to add to that list depression as we understand it today. Now, in English, the term depression was applied to the very severe disturbance that very few people had that resulted in hospitalisation and a great deal of disability. And, you know, 50, 100 years ago, that was what depression looked like. It was something that was rarely talked about except amongst people who were hospitalised, had very high suicide rates and very high levels of dysfunction associated with it. But what we talk about when we label something depression today is quite different from that. But the difference is kind of hidden, and we have to go to other cultures to see that spelt out more clearly. And in Japanese culture, the term that was used for that severe form of depression was something that didn't lend itself to be used to describe the much lower level feelings of distress and suffering that we use the label for in our society. And the effect of that was quite dramatic. Antidepressants didn't take off in Japan. And it wasn't until somebody somewhere, probably in marketing, came up with the notion that apparently translates roughly to cold of the soul. This term was something that Japanese society could embrace in much the same way that our society embraces the concept of depression as something that everybody can have and that we mustn't be ashamed of and that there are good treatments for and that life can be made better if we all acknowledge our depression and treat it appropriately. Another social force that I think is really important in shaping the epidemic of mental illness is our intolerance of uncomfortable feelings, our intolerance of suffering, our intolerance of ordinary, unpleasant feelings. And, you know, it actually only takes you 2 weeks to get a diagnosis of depression. You don't have to feel bad for very long to get that diagnosis. And there's this whole idea of pursuit of happiness as an end in itself. And, in fact, I think the thinker in residence who's coming to Adelaide this year makes it his business to have us all pursue happiness. And there's a wonderful book by Barbara Eichenreich called Smile or Die, which talks about the pressure on people to be happy, and in particular she was somebody who had breast cancer and really got the message that many people with cancer get, which is that, you know, the kind of Lance Armstrong view of it, that if you're a good enough person and you're strong enough and you're positive enough, your cancer will go away. And if it happens to kill you, that's because you haven't tried hard enough. And I think Eichenreich's work is a wonderful antidote to that kind of thinking. But it also taps into this idea that happiness is an end in itself, something that we should pursue. And I think that's a real misperception of what it is as an emotional state. And happiness is a marker. It's something that we experience in certain circumstances in life, and it's not something that we pursue for its own sake. What we should be pursuing is a good life, whatever that is. And if we pursue a good life and we're successful and lucky in our pursuit of a good life, then for large periods of our life we'll feel happy. But part of a good life is also to feel sad and miserable and upset and angry and all of those other feelings. And, you know, I'm not advocating joy in suffering or any sort of extreme Calvinist approach to life, but I am saying that we have to be much more open to and accepting of uncomfortable and unpleasant feelings. And not just in ourselves, but also in our children. Most of us have had the experience in parents of getting panicky about our children feeling the slightest bit unhappy and feeling that it's our obligation to make things right for them. And maybe that's not the kind of parenting that they always need. So with that background in mind, I want you to imagine a child who's in... I want to go back now to the idea of us having a range of symptoms that are available to us from our bodies, feedback from our bodies all the time. And that if we're in a state of what you might term disarousal, that is some kind of intoxication or unhappiness or anxiety or distress, that we're inclined to become preoccupied with those symptoms, whether they're coming from our body or coming from our emotions or from our mind. And if you imagine a child who's in some kind of a predicament, maybe her parents are fighting a lot and she's very uncomfortable about that. Children have a really limited number of ways in which they can tell us that things aren't right in their life. And ideally, we'd like this little girl to come to somebody and or go to her parents and say, look, I can't bear you fighting anymore and it makes me sick and gives me a tummy ache when you do it and I want you to stop. But most kids can't do that, and maybe the tummy ache doesn't go away when they do. But let's imagine that it's a tummy ache for this girl. It might be behaviour problems for another child, or it might be withdrawal and apparent depression for a third child. And this little girl becomes increasingly preoccupied with her tummy pain, which is very real and very distressing to her. And if things go, if the cards fall in a certain way, she finds herself in an emergency department or in a doctor's surgery. And the doctor gets worried about the pain that she has and investigates it extensively. And we've got an illness. What we have is something, a series of symptoms, which would be better thought about as symptoms of a predicament, actually being interpreted as symptoms of an illness. And it's not until somebody can grasp the meaning of those symptoms that this is a guts ache that's brought on by mum and dad fighting, and that doing something about mum and dad fighting is the intervention that's needed. It's not until that happens that we've really explained what's going on for the little girl. We can put all kinds of labels on her experience, but they don't constitute explanations.
Adelaide child psychiatrist and Professor John Jureidini on All in the Mind. This week, coming to you from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas, and you're with ABC Radio National. So let's pick up again with Dr. Jureidini's provocation for his profession in his talk, Sick, Screwed Up, or Just Lazy? And a language warning for this second half of the show, as we're obliged to do.
So I'm suggesting that a lot of mental health, mental illness, is socially determined. There's nothing very controversial about that. And it's not, of course, just mental problems that are socially determined, and it doesn't mean that something's not real if it's socially determined. If we take, for example, type 2 diabetes, of which there's an epidemic in our society, that's quite clearly socially determined. It's very much related to obesity, which in turn is very clearly related to poverty and deprivation. The poorer you are, the more likely you are to be obese. And those social factors are things that we should be doing something about, but that doesn't mean that we don't have to treat diabetes. When somebody presents with diabetes, we need to treat it. And you might argue that all of the things I've said about the social determinants of mental illness amount to the same thing, that when somebody presents with some kind of mental illness, then that needs to be treated on its merits, independent of whether it's been caused by social factors or not. But there is a significant difference, because diabetes explains what the person who has diabetes is suffering from. It's quite straightforward to give an explanation of how the person with diabetes comes to experience all of the range of symptoms that they have. Depression, on the other hand, explains nothing, and at best it describes. Now, depression as a description can be a relatively benign label. If somebody goes to the doctor and the doctor says, I think what you're experiencing could be described as depression, and this is a condition that's quite common in our society, and it tends to last weeks rather than months, and you've had it for several weeks now, so you can expect it to go away relatively soon, but why don't you come back in a couple of weeks and let me know how you're going with it. Might sound like nothing, but it actually has a name. It's called watchful waiting, and it's the recommended treatment for mild to moderate depression. And that's a very relatively benign process, because what's being acknowledged there is that depression is a description of the person's experience, in much the same way that attention deficit disorder is not a bad description of a pattern of inattentiveness and overactivity and impulsivity. But it's when these descriptions masquerade as explanations that things become dangerous. The trouble with most of our mental health labels or categories is that they are unexplanatory. I think that at the risk of using a non-word, that they constitute unexplanations. An unexplanation is different from an error. It's not that you've got the explanation wrong. It's also different from uncertainty, which is the theme of this festival, because an unexplanation actually, to a certain extent, represents an intolerance of uncertainty, the need to come up with something, a label for the experience. It has some cousins, unexplanation, I think, and perhaps one of them is the philosopher Frankfurt wrote an essay some years ago called On Bullshit. It's a really worthwhile little book to read. And what he tries to capture with the notion of bullshit and distinguishing it from lies is the idea that there is inherent in it a reckless disregard for the truth. And I think that the problem with our psychiatric labels, our unexplanatory psychiatric labels, is their inauthenticity. Sickness is an unexplanation or unexplanatory for most young people's distress. So where do we go looking for something that might do better as an explanation? I have gone to a poem by Philip Larkin, which is well known, and begins, "They fuck you up, your mum and dad." I prefer the notion of being fucked up to the notion of being sick as an attempt to explain young people's distress. I apologise for the use of the crude term, but it captures, in a way that no other term I can find, a difference between two apparently mutually contradictory processes that are going on. The first is the sense that Larkin's talking about. It's not just mum and dad, obviously, but a whole series of life circumstances and, you know, intoxication and head injuries and a whole range of things can have the effect. And this is what's been done to you or been done to the young person. But the other sense of it is of having fucked up, of having done those things which we ought not to have done and left undone those things which we ought to have done. And getting right what's the contribution of those two different senses of that term, I think, is a big part of the work that we do in making sense of our suffering and distress and unhappiness. And you might think that with young people, they're going to tend more towards focusing on what's been done to them and not taking responsibility for their contribution to it. But if I just recall an experience that I had on call yesterday when I went into the hospital to see a young person who'd been admitted apparently with depression, who came from a very abusive background and whose onset of depression had been brought about by the fact that he'd been a heavy drug user and had abruptly stopped using drugs and now was confronted with all of the things that had been hidden by his use of drugs. And some of those things related to how much trouble his parents were in and how frightened and impotent he felt in the face of that. But his take on what he was going through was that he had failed, that he was being aggressive at home, which he was, that he was behaving in a way that was unpleasant for his mother, which he was. But a much more sort of mature understanding of what was happening was to see him as having been screwed up by his circumstances, not as was being constantly told to him by police and all the other people who were involved, that he had screwed up and was responsible for the distress and unhappiness in his family. So one common way that young people screw up is by taking overdoses. When I'm teaching about the importance of explanation in understanding and dealing with young people's distress. I use a case example of a 16-year-old girl who lives with her mother and younger brother in what appears to be a happy and functional family, who's taken an overdose that's moderately severe and has ended up in hospital. And when asked why she took the overdose, she says, "I broke up with my boyfriend." And of course, that's not an explanation, because hundreds of girls have broken up with their boyfriend every day, and most of them haven't taken a serious overdose. And so I get the trainees to ask me questions about what they think that might illuminate, provide an explanation of why the girls behaved in this way. And the first set of questions that they tend to ask are about her mood and her depression, and pretty quickly it's established that she meets the criteria for a moderately severe depression. I ask them whether that's an explanation, and some of them think that it is, but most of them think that it's not really, because they know that I'm not going to like it if they say that it is. And so the next set of questions they tend to ask are about the nature of the breakup, and I make it that the breakup's been relatively benign, that they've been together for 6 months, it's been a nice relationship, he's been kind to her, but he doesn't want to be in a serious relationship, you know, it's all about me, it's not about you, kind of thing. So there's not been anything particularly toxic about that breakup, and that doesn't explain why she's become suicidal. We plug away for a while, and eventually it comes out that, or somebody expresses an interest in where Dad might be in the process. And it turns out that the parents divorced when the girl was 2 years old. Dad disappeared from the scene and had no contact with her until she was 11 or 12, at which time he made tentative attempts to come back into her life, and they gradually built a relationship. And then about the time that she started up with the boyfriend, he got a transfer interstate, again interrupting their relationship. And so now we have an explanation, don't we? Because we can see that the breakup with the boyfriend, which is, you know, troubling but a relatively benign process in a young person's life, resonates with the abandonment experience that she's had from her father. And so, whereas on the one hand, if we went down the mental illness line, we'd be able to say, well, she's depressed, and people who are depressed often make suicide attempts, and we can give her some treatment for her depression, whether that's drugs or cognitive behavioural therapy or something, and she might have got better, she might have done really well with that process. But I think the alternative process, which is to come up with an explanation for her suicide attempt and for her distress, that doesn't amount to a medical label but amounts to a story about the relationship that she had with her father and what went wrong with that and how that was recapitulated in a relationship with her boyfriend, has potentially a different set of outcomes. And you know, the outcome that it had in this case was that the mother said something like, she burst into tears actually and said, "Oh, now I kind of see it. I always thought, you know, your father was a dead shit and it was a good thing that he was out of your life, but now I can see how difficult that was for you, and perhaps I shouldn't have said all of those awful things about him." And the fact that the mother's response to the child's overdose is warm and supportive in that way then means that the family are discharged. You know, maybe there's some psychiatric follow-up organised, but I'm feeling kind of confident that this experience has set the young person up for growth rather than, and you know, that we know that people can grow and develop out of crises. Now, the fact that I use that case for a teaching example gives it away, doesn't it, really, because it's not usually as straightforward and as dramatic as that. But it is the case that people come to us with a fairly limited repertoire of themes. Everybody's got a different story, but the themes are relatively limited. And a prominent Adelaide real estate agent once explained to me that the only two forces that control the world are fear and greed. And I think Melanie Klein actually said something quite similar to that. But if you substitute hunger for greed, I think most of the people who come to see me are generally frightened of something or hungry for something, usually relationships of some sort, and they're in pain, and they have, as a product of that or going along with that, some level of disarousal. They don't feel emotionally and physically and physiologically as they would want to. So those are the kind of themes that I've got to work with. I don't have to start from scratch. I know the kind of territory that I'm likely to encounter. But if I respond as a lot of conventional psychiatric and psychological practice does, just to the pain and the disarousal, which is a very understandable response because nobody likes to see somebody in pain and we want to ease suffering. But if I respond just to that, then I might be offering analgesia at the expense of understanding. Whereas the approach that I'm advocating might in many cases prolong the pain that people are experiencing, but it might be with the added benefit of immunizing people against further difficulties and distress later in life. And actually now there's increasing concern about the role of psychiatric drugs in just this way. There's very little doubt that many psychiatric drugs, whether they're prescribed ones or ones that you buy in the pub or on the street, take away pain in the short term and do a good job of that. And they enhance functioning in the short term and they do a good job of that. And many of them have few side effects for many of us who take them. But there is increasing concern that that might not be the outcome in the longer term. That one of the reasons why there's more depression around and more recurrence of depression might be that we're treating it earlier and more frequently with antidepressants, which while they may reduce and shorten that episode of depression, may predispose us to further episodes of depression. Now, that's by no means proven. It's something to worry about rather than something to necessarily act on. But it does anyway fit, even if it's not a physiological effect, it does fit with the idea that avoiding pain might not be the best long-term strategy. It might be a better short-term than long-term strategy. So this might make some people puke, but what I think the psychiatric enterprise is about, and the psychological enterprise, is about providing a safe, validating environment in which our patients can, with our help, come to some kind of authentic account of where they are and how they got there. Now, it's not the case that just any story will do. When we set out to develop a narrative with our patients about who they are and how they got there, we have to strive towards an authentic story. What is an authentic story? Well, that's something that perhaps our novelists are better placed to judge than our therapists. But it's not very different from the scientific process where we develop a hypothesis and we test it and we improve it and we enhance it, and we're always trying to make better sense of circumstances, and the narrative task is to bring that all together into a coherent, cohesive and meaningful story. That, I think, is something that we must always be treating with the same kind of skepticism that I advocated at the beginning of my talk we should direct towards drug treatments and conventional psychiatric assessments. That the story that I come up with my patient needs to be always interrogated and re-examined to see whether it's not just something that suits me and them to avoid some kind of conflict, but it's actually the best and most authentic story that can be developed for that person at that time. So my conclusion is that what helps us survive in an uncertain environment when things don't go well for us is not so much good drugs, good diagnoses, but good stories. Thank you.
Adelaide child psychiatrist Professor John Jureidini speaking at this year's Adelaide Festival of Ideas. And the questions from the floor at the Festival of Ideas are always interesting. You can catch that robust exchange as extra audio over on the All in the Mind blog. And so over to you. I know you'll have things to say on this one. Get writing from your own experiences, perhaps. Look for Add Your Comment on this week's show on our website, abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. And by the way, I've upgraded the old Facebook group to a new All in the Mind Facebook page. Head on over, another place for your discussion, as well as on Twitter. Find me at All in the Mind. Thanks to the Adelaide ABC team and Radio Adelaide for recording today's talk. Thanks to Maria Tickle, and I'm Natasha Mitchell. Catch you next week for our big population weekend. The world is about to hit 7 billion humble humans. What a thought.
Hi, Damien Carrick here. Would you jump into a taxi if you knew that your cab driver had stabbed his wife to death? Would it make a difference if you found out that he was found not guilty by way of insanity? The killing happened 22 years ago. The medical experts say he's fit to get behind a wheel. He's worked in aged care and even been the primary carer for a child with leukaemia. Would all this change your mind? What did the court decide? Find out on The Law Report. And you can download or stream this program from the Radio National website.